This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com. Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com.
Welcome to the briefing room with me, David Aronovich. We're in a room and we get briefed. So if you really want to know what's going on in the world, then do listen to this podcast. And please let us know what you think by writing a review or rating us on iTunes or your podcast provider. If you're minded to do so, please recommend us to your friends. Or for that matter, to your enemies.
Villages are being burnt constantly, and they've continued to be burnt up to now. We happened to come across a village that had just been set on fire. And we found, in fact, there were Rakhine Buddhist toughs, young men with machetes, who'd actually set it on fire in front of the police, clearly with official connivance.
We are concerned to hear that numbers of Muslims are fleeing across the border to Bangladesh. We want to find out why this exodus is happening. We would like to talk to those who have fled as well as to those who have stayed.
Myanmar's de facto leader and Nobel Peace Laureate Aung San Suu Kyi saying she doesn't know why ethnic Rohingya Muslims are fleeing Burma's Rakhine province and the country. Yet the UN says that what's going on seems to be a textbook case of ethnic cleansing. So who are the Rohingya? Why the panicked exodus? And there's another big problem.
Myanmar has put itself on the global map. It's become the cause célèbre of the modern day for much of the Muslim world, just as Kosovo was for a previous generation. And I think that greatly increases the risks.
What does it mean for Myanmar, the region, and indeed for us? Step into the briefing room and find out. First, the who's and the where's. Dr. Lee Jones is an expert on Myanmar and its history.
Yet the birth of a nation can also be achieved by peaceful means. For to the 15 million people of Burma, independence came by common consent. After 62 years of British rule, the king's last representative, Governor Sir Hubert Rance, leaves Rangoon.
Before 1948, the state of Burma was ruled as part of the Indian Raj by the British. Despite what you've just heard, there was no real consent among the different ethnic groups inside Burma on the shape of the state or power sharing or anything like that. And indeed, before the state was even formed, there were ethnic separatist insurgencies, including in Rakhine State. And even before independence, there had been riots against Muslims in the 1930s as a proxy for attacking the imperial power. During colonialism, a lot of Muslims and ethnic Indians had come down into Burma, and there was a lot of resentment against their increasing economic power in the 1930s.
To the people of Burma, newly won independence will not bring an immediate change to their life. Their country was twice a battleground. Today, few national assets are left. Oil refineries are in ruins, and big rice and teak exports are paralyzed. Against this somber background, Burmans celebrate Independence Day.
Burma is home to the world's longest-running ethnic insurgencies, and this is the main crisis that the state has faced from its inception. So it lost control of all its borders during the Cold War, and the threat of dissolution of the state led to military intervention in 1958 and again in 1960, and the installation of a military-backed one-party state from 1960 through to 1988, when it collapsed in the face of mass protest and ongoing ethnic insurgencies. And then the military had to step in again and very brutally quelled the unrest and ruled then until 2010-2011. Myanmar has a dominant ethnic group, the Bama, after whom Burma was named. They comprise about 68% of the population, and there are various ethnic minority groups, some of whom are recognised as among the 135 so-called national races who belong to Myanmar and have citizenship status. The Rohingya are an ethnic minority living in Rakhine State in western Burma. They're a Muslim minority. In the 1950s through the early 1970s, they were recognised as an ethnic minority and courted politically. But from the early to mid-1970s onwards, there was rising Islamophobia in the country, and the military staged its first attacks on this community in clearance operations in the late 1970s. And through the 1980s, they were then stripped of their citizenship, becoming the world's largest stateless population. And now there is hardly anybody in the country who recognises the Rohingya as one of the 135 national races. Because they were stripped of their citizenship, they are subject to enormous restrictions and constraints. So they're confined spatially. They find it very difficult to move around, to access healthcare and education. And there are restrictions on family planning and attempts to force them to contain the size of their families, because there is a widespread perception in Myanmar, however mistaken this may be, that there is a demographic tidal wave of Muslims coming into the country and swamping Buddhism and threatening Buddhist culture. So they've lived in really quite atrocious conditions for a good 20 plus years. In the West, we've tended to focus on the struggle between the military regime and democracy activists and holding up Aung San Suu Kyi as an icon of that resistance movement. But the main crisis in Burma all the way through from independence has been the struggle between ethnic groups and the military's quest to maintain order and prevent ethnic separatism all the way through the Cold War. And this was something that Aung San Suu Kyi referenced in her Nobel Prize acceptance speech in 2012.
Burma is a country of many ethnic nationalities, and faith in its future can be founded only on a true spirit of union. Since we achieved independence in 1948, there never was, it has been, a time when we could claim the whole country was at peace. One unconsidered move can be enough to remove long-standing ceasefires.
What she was talking about there in that speech was not the Rohingyas, but the ceasefires that the previous military regime had been able to strike with the recognised ethnic minority armed groups, which have been in war against the government since the 1960s. But ironically, shortly after she gave that speech, there was a flare-up in communal violence in Rakhine State between the ethnic Rakhine Buddhists and the Rohingya Muslims. And that led to increasing security operations and a crackdown that then sparked growing Rohingya militancy, and their attacks on police and army outposts is what has sparked the latest refugee outflow.
Dr. Lee Jones. Exactly who are the Rohingya insurgents? Richard Horsey is a Myanmar analyst who's advised the International Crisis Group. He spoke to me from the city of Yangon in Myanmar.
So this group is called the Arakan Rohingya Salvation Army, otherwise known as Haraka al-Yakin, which means faith movement in Arabic. It was established in 2013, following two serious bouts of intercommunal violence in Rakhine State the year before. And it was established by a group of Rohingya emigres in Saudi Arabia, along with a number of other Rohingya emigres in other parts of the world, including Malaysia. And they spent a couple of years organizing, mobilizing, and training cells within the villages of northern Rakhine. And it wasn't until October last year that they launched their first attacks. And this attacks last month on the 25th of August were the second round of attacks that they've launched.
So their first attacks were in October 2016. What kind of attacks were they?
That was a coordinated attack on three border police posts in this part of northern Rakhine State, which is reasonably close to the Bangladesh border. That came, I think, as a shock to the security forces. They weren't prepared for it. They killed a number of border police. They took over the border police headquarters, a very large military or security establishment. They gained control of that base and looted its armory of thousands, tens of thousands of rounds of ammunition and dozens of guns. And then they disappeared. And as we know, you know, that prompted a disproportionate military response.
You've talked about how they had finance an organisation from Saudi Arabia. Do they fit into the pattern of other Salafist jihadist groups like Al-Qaeda, or are they different?
No, they're very different. Firstly, their objective, or at least their stated objective, is to promote the rights of the Rohingya in Myanmar. So unlike international jihadist groups, they are not calling for Sharia law. They are not attacking religious targets. They are not attacking urban targets outside of their area of interest. They are instead focusing on attacking the security forces. And in a sense, the Rohingya diaspora and the Rohingya themselves in Myanmar, most of the political support they receive and the tangible support in terms of humanitarian aid is coming from the West. And so that doesn't fit very well with the international jihadist narrative. And it's really been, you know, Europe, the UK, the United States that have been most vocal over the years about the treatment of the Rohingya in Myanmar and who've been the leading providers of humanitarian assistance to that part of northern Rakhine State.
And that's recognised by the Rohingya insurgents as well, is it?
I think it is. And the leading political actors, the political émigrés, they're in Saudi, they're in Malaysia, but they're also in California, they're also in London. And I think when ASA, the insurgent group, emerged with a name, Haraka al-Yakin, which means faith group in Arabic, calling for jihad, I think this alarmed the political leaders of the Rohingya diaspora, and they felt that this group could too easily be pigeonholed along with other jihadist groups. And that's why I think the group rebranded itself earlier this year with an English name, the Arakan Rohingya Salvation Army. And its statements since have tried to distance themselves from global jihadist groups.
In terms of their strength, how numerous are they and what kind of weaponry do they possess?
So this is a difficult question to answer because the modus operandi of this group has been to establish cells within villages across the north of Rakhine State. So these are people who've been taken out of the villages, trained for a couple of weeks, and then sent back to the villages. They don't wear uniforms and they don't carry guns. And that group of people who have access to various forms of farm tools, spears, catapults, machetes, they are the core strength of this group. And those cells, prior to attacks, have been motivating, you know, disaffected young men in the villages to join them, people who don't have any training, just to pick up whatever sharp object is to hand and join them in a raid on a security target. So it's not so much about military strength. It's really their attempt to mobilize the general population. And that does make it extraordinarily difficult for the Myanmar security forces to distinguish combatants from non-combatants. For years, this population has felt that it's in a pressure cooker from which there is no real escape. And it's created a sense of hopelessness and desperation. And it's that which has allowed this group to mobilise the local population behind what might be seen as an almost suicidal agenda. And we've seen this in other places in the world. When you have hopelessness and desperation, it's breeding grounds for this kind of situation.
But you've talked about how this situation, they have a, if you like, a kind of relatively localised agenda. In other situations, we've seen that this can open a vacuum into which much better armed and much more what we would call ruthless groups can step because they seem to offer a better military response.
I think that's absolutely right. I think the risk is that you have 400,000 to 500,000 deeply traumatized people in Bangladesh who are angry, who see no hope for the future. And that is ripe for, you know, recruiting by other organizations who may not have Myanmar as their main agenda.
Now, Al-Qaeda have already released a statement saying that they were urging Muslims around the world to support their fellow Muslims in Myanmar. And it does, as you say, seem ripe for the intervention of jihadis in the Myanmar situation. Are there any signs yet that this is happening?
Other than statements and other than the odd individual case of people who have either expressed an interest or may actually have travelled to the region, no, there is not concrete indications of that. But I think it is an extraordinarily real risk. And I think that beyond that, there's an even greater risk for Myanmar. And that is that it's put itself on the global map as the preeminent current case of abuse of a Muslim minority. Now, whether that is an accurate description of what's going on or not is largely irrelevant. It is widely believed across the Muslim world. And that's an extraordinarily dangerous thing for Myanmar to do. It's become the cause célèbre of the modern day for much of the Muslim world, just as Kosovo was for a previous generation. And I think that greatly increases the risks that Myanmar will be seen as an important target for these international jihadist groups. And there we're not talking about a few dozen fighters going to remote northern Rakhine state to attack border police. We're talking about Myanmar as a nation being a target. And I think that is a very scary prospect and something that Myanmar should be very concerned about.
Richard Horsey. The UN Human Rights Chief, Zayed Raad Al Hussein, has urged Myanmar to end what he called the cruel military operation in Rakhine State.
The situation remains, or seems, a textbook example of ethnic cleansing. The Myanmar government should stop pretending that the Rohingyas are setting fire to their own homes and laying waste to their own villages.
Professor Penny Green is director of the International State Crime Institute, which is affiliated to various universities. She's carried out extensive field research interviewing people about the crisis in Rakhine State.
Following the violence in June 2012 and October later that year, the Rohingya were forced out of their neighbourhoods, out of their houses, into what is now a detention camp complex. They were forced out by mobs of Rakhine perpetrators who were burning down the homes of the Rohingya at that time. So we spoke to them in camps and in the remaining ghetto inside Sitwe. Sitwe is the capital of Rakhine State. This is a ghetto which has 7 checkpoints and is the home to 4,500 Rohingya. They're completely isolated from the rest of the town, as are those living inside the camps. There are approximately 120,000 to 140,000 Rohingya currently in those camps. And the conditions under which they live are utterly squalid.
Is there any significant mixing at all now between Rohingyas and others?
Well, certainly in Sitwe and in many parts of Rakhine State, there is no mixing at all. It's an apartheid situation.
So what proportion of the Rohingya that are left in Rakhine State are in these camps?
When we began our research, there were about 1.2 million estimated Rohingya living in Rakhine State. Inside the camps, we have around 140,000 people. Since the village clearances that the Burmese state has been engaged in, the military has engaged in since October last year, we've had mass exodus. I mean, people have fled for their lives, hundreds of thousands. Well over 420,000 people have fled in the most recent attacks since August 25th this year. What people don't know, I think, is that there were already between 500,000 and 700,000 Rohingya who had fled previous pogroms, who were living on the other side in Bangladesh of the Naf River. So they are in camps, largely unregistered. So at the moment, we are looking at almost 1 million Rohingya living in Bangladesh in camps, leaving, I think, an estimated 700,000 in Rakhine State as a whole. So if you understand this as a genocide, which we do, the state has been largely effective. They have been forced out. They have been murdered en masse. They have been dehumanized. Their identity has been stripped from them.
Why are the majority doing this?
Well, I think the state has been very successful in mobilising the Rakhine. The Rakhine themselves hold serious grievances against the Burmese state. Rakhine State is the second poorest in the country. It's severely underdeveloped. It is rich in natural resources, but those resources have always gone directly to the military and now to Chinese, South Korean and Indian corporations. So the whole state is a very impoverished place. The Rakhine have been encouraged to believe that it is the Islamic Rohingya who are responsible for their lack of educational opportunities, for their poverty, for their underdevelopment.
So who conveys this message to them?
It happens in a number of ways and in quite a coordinated way. The state itself is responsible. We've had officials from the Myanmar government describing Rohingya in vile terms, equating them to African carp. It's very reminiscent of the way in which the Rwandan government portrayed the Tutsis and the Nazis portrayed the Jews. So we've seen that kind of stigmatisation throughout the country. The Buddhist monks, the Sangha, have been particularly virulent in their hate campaigns, and they have been a very significant conveyor of this message of Islamophobia.
Did you get the impression that there was any way that the Rohingya on the one side and the Buddhist Rakhine majority on the other could be reconciled, or had things ideologically gone too far?
When we did our interviews, I did think that reconciliation was indeed possible, but it certainly will not be possible with this particular Burmese government and while attitudes remain as they are. Islamophobia and xenophobic currents run very deep inside the country, and there has been nothing to challenge it. During the campaign for the democratic elections in 2015, the NLD, Aung San Suu Kyi's party, made sure that no Muslim candidates were stood. This was the first time in 2010 elections, the NLD stood Muslim candidates. This time they did not. Aung San Suu Kyi herself did not visit Rakhine State, would not acknowledge the Rohingya, and the Rohingya were denied the right to vote.
In this discussion, you've used the term genocide. The United Nations so far is not using that term.
Well, the UN is using the term ethnic cleansing. Ethnic cleansing is not a legal term. There is no law against ethnic cleansing. And in fact, ethnic cleansing is a euphemism for genocide. And I think it's really important to understand that genocide is not simply an immediate act of mass violence in which an ethnic or religious or racial group is destroyed. Genocide is a process. It takes place over many years normally. And it begins with practices of dehumanisation and the kind of stigmatisation I've talked about. I think, given the events of October 2016, the village clearances which began then, and the events of August 25th onwards, with the mass burnings of villages and the mass killings of Rohingya, we have entered, I think, the end stages of the genocide.
Why don't the UN and other people want to use the word genocide?
I think it's because once a state or the UN has decided and declared that a genocide is taking place, there is an obligation on states to act to prevent and punish. And this is something we know that the international community is extremely reluctant to do.
Professor Penny Green. Joining me in the briefing room is Dr. Champa Patel, who is head of the Asia programme at the foreign affairs think tank Chatham House. Dr. Patel, what has the regional reaction been to the Rohingya crisis?
Well, it's been an interesting response from a range of different parties. So if we were to take the key players in turn. So I think if we think about Bangladesh, which is bearing the brunt of the displacement at the moment, it's a poor country, densely populated, already home to a historically displaced Rohingya community. So it cannot deal with this crisis alone. And I think a lot of the coverage has concentrated on the humanitarian crisis, understandably, that it's currently dealing with. But I think there's a political aspect to this that we wouldn't want to lose, which is domestically, while they're currently welcoming of the refugees, this is a secular government that's tried to clamp down hard on Islamist groups. And you have the opposition groups in Bangladesh who are more religiously motivated already attacking the government to say that they're not doing enough to help the Rohingya. So I think it's one to watch, because while currently welcoming, that may change. if there isn't an end sight to the current crisis. Moving on to ASEAN, which is the regional institution that's meant to deal with peace and stability in the Southeast Asia region. I think what's interesting is that countries like Indonesia and Malaysia are either sending people directly to Myanmar or Bangladesh, or quite vocal in their concern and condemnation of what's happening. But there's been absolutely no coordinated multilateral response. At the moment, ASEAN is prioritizing non-interference more than ensuring stability in the region. And I think then there are players like India, China, who see opportunities in the current crisis. So this is a space where they think they can influence and gain something in a way that they're not necessarily driving towards a resolution either.
So what could India or China possibly gain out of the current situation?
I think for India and China, they're balancing economic interests in the country. So I think India very much sees Myanmar as key. You know, it sees it as a land corridor to Southeast Asia. It sees it as a country in which it can increase trade and investment relationships. So Myanmar, from an Indian perspective, is very, very important. But secondly, it doesn't want China to have a massive foothold in the country either. So in that respect, they're not going to come out and openly criticize Aung San Suu Kyi, because I think we have to remember it's a new democracy as well. So they're not going to want to do anything that strengthens the hand of the former military junta. And I think with India, it also plays to domestic concerns, because a lot of Rohingya are displaced in India, not to the numbers that they're displaced in Bangladesh, but still a substantial community, mainly settled around Jammu and Kashmir. And I think there's a particular kind of narrative that it speaks to, where they can say, oh, you know, the Rohingya are a terrorist threat. They're linked to Pakistan-based armed groups. So it appeals to a particular right-wing view in India that aligns Muslim refugees with an Islamist threat.
So this kind of fits in with President Modi's Hindu perspective, doesn't it?
Absolutely. And I think it's interesting because there are a very small number of Hindu refugees as well who have currently migrated to Bangladesh and are seeking asylum in India. And they've been very quiet on the question of what happens to those Hindu refugees, because the displacement isn't just Muslim communities. It is overwhelmingly Muslim communities, but there are also smaller numbers of Christian and Hindu refugees as well who are affected by the current crisis.
Wouldn't one solution be for Aung San Suu Kyi just to change the Rohingyas' citizenship status, to actually give it to them? I mean, that would help, wouldn't it?
I think politically she's taken, and you know, people will disagree with her on this, and I think there's been a lot of vocal criticism of her on this. So I think it's worth reflecting on the fact that she doesn't control the majority of government. The military still control, you know, the key ministries that are responsible for army, police, etc. They hold 25% of all seats in government. So in that respect, she doesn't have a free hand. She's not directly responsible for the ministries that are responsible for these disproportionate attacks. And in some respects, she's between a rock and a hard place. You know, if she sides with the Rohingya, she could face a powerful backlash from the military that could destabilize the fragile power sharing arrangement that they have at the moment. But she could also alienate a large share of voters. In my view, I think by remaining silent, she's severely damaging her moral authority.
Can we be certain that Aung San Suu Kyi actually wants the Rohingyas to be part of Myanmar's citizenry?
It's really difficult to tell, because there's very little she has said publicly that could be taken to support, you know, that kind of sentiment. She tends not to refer to them by name, which would make one think that she's not predisposed. But I'd be reluctant to kind of ascribe that to her, because I think what is interesting is the absence of any firm position on this situation. And I think, again, it's to play into domestic politics, because she knows there's a substantial majority of her supporters that do not recognise the Rohingya as part of Myanmar.
Champa Patel, thank you very much. Well, I'll try and sum up what we've heard, which is the UN calls what's going on ethnic cleansing. It's part of a process that's been going on for some time. And as far as we can tell, no regional actor, no local actor is prepared to take the action that would stop it. And therefore, it looks as if it will go on to its completion. And one possible consequence of that would be yet another conflict area which is ripe for radicalisation. On that rather bleak note, my thanks to Dr. Lee Jones, Richard Horsey, Professor Penny Green and Dr. Champa Patel. We'll be back at the same time next week. Good night. The Briefing Room was presented by me, David Aronovich, and produced by Javier Zapata. Please let us know what you think about this programme or the entire series. You can do that by writing a review or rating us on iTunes or your podcast provider. We look forward to reading your comments.